We'll move on to the next question. And the Financial Condition Committee, I mentioned we adopted a new process for national issues of national significance to be brought to the committee so that we don't end up with a single state solution. And you know, and specifically, Paul, I'll give it to you as the industry representative here. If that process had been in place back when AAAX first went into effect, and when the first companies, I guess, were thinking about forming, you know, a captive to finance that excess reserve, do you think it would have helped with, you know, perhaps bringing it to the forefront sooner and perhaps stopping, I guess, the formation or the beginning of these captive solutions?
Well, it certainly would have brought it to the forefront sooner, although I think most people realized very quickly after Model 830 was adopted that there were some mistakes in it and it was overly conservative. And it was realized relatively quickly. There's also a realization that AG 38 had all kinds of I don't want to call them loopholes, but differing interpretations that were actually hard to nail down. And so very quickly, the PBR project started, you know, 2004. Here we are, 2015. So the solution that we were looking for has taken 11 years. I don't know if at the time, if everybody said, well, you realize if we don't do this quickly, we're going to have, you know, single state solutions out there, that it would have impacted the speed at which we would have gotten PBR done. I mean, there was a lot of issues to work through. And that's probably, you know, the most extreme type of project that the NEIC may ever undertake in terms of timelines. But even there, you know, if you go back to some of the variable annuity issues, I think Oliver Wyman did a report in 2010 on some of these issues, and you know, we're 5 years later, and you know, we're starting to address them now. So if we really want the e-committee process to work, there's got to be sort of a commitment by everybody, regulators and industry alike, to you know, move with due haste towards national solutions. And you know, for all sorts of reasons, that can be difficult.
Thank you, Paul. It's a very interesting point. And it is, PBR was probably the biggest challenge we've tackled in ever, maybe statutory accounting codification project. Back in the 90s, but PBR has been a difficult issue, and I agree it probably wouldn't have completely prevented it at all or made us move that much more quickly on PBR, but it would have been interesting to see if we could have done something in shorter than an 11-year period on PBR.
What might have happened is there might have been what we'll call some other interim solutions. There were all kinds of interim solutions along the way for AG 38. There might have been some other interim solutions that we dealt with while PBR was being built. That probably would have been the most we would have gotten.
And don't forget the AG 38 compromise that we went through too. That was,
yeah, exactly. That was one of the interim solutions.
Yeah, that was extremely difficult. Again, Rector and Associates helped us out with that one. Okay, so I'll address this one to Commissioner Gerhart. And as the chair of the Variable Annuities Issues Working Group, what work has the working group done towards enhancing transparency through disclosure? And what other things is the working group contemplating in regards to variable annuities? I know there's a lot going on, but if you could kind of give us a quick overview of what we've done so far.
I'll try to do a quick overview. And just a side note, I was talking to Jim Armstrong one evening, and my wife overheard our conversation on one of these issues, and she said, "What in the hell are you guys talking about?" So I do appreciate your mom test you said earlier about trying to keep it simple, but what you forgot to say was your mom's an actuary, right? So, you know, it's a complex issue, and the working group's done a lot of really good work in pretty short order. We were constituted in March, so pretty quick order. The first thing we wanted to do was really race to transparency to try and cut off some of that the dialogue that's been out there around these. And I give the group a lot of credit, but we went to the industry first and said, let come up with some framework to have some disclosure, because we wanted to have it in place, year end. Wanted something working pretty quickly. And quite frankly, I think, they should take some responsibility for these misconceptions, because as regulators, we probably would have preferred a different avenue other than captives, but we are where we are, and so we want to work through that very quickly. We've had several phone calls. We had that in-person meeting that you mentioned, Joe, and I'm just going to cover real quickly what the disclosure covers. It covers the type of benefits being reinsured, including information on the guaranteed benefits, the amount of reserve ceded and the reserve method used, the amount of collateral supporting the agreement, the risks associated with the cession, and the risks retained by the reporting entity and its parent and affiliates. And I think the most important thing is the purpose of the transaction. So, the disclosure, I think, is a very helpful tool. We also sent a referral to FOG, the Financial Analysis Working Group, suggesting that they gather pro forma RBC information on a confidential basis for these transactions. And that was a lot of good work done pretty quickly, but I would submit it was probably not the major part of what we're trying to accomplish here. What we're really trying to accomplish is looking at the framework in total and eliminating the need for these transactions. I know that's a heavy lift, but as you mentioned, Joe, we did hire a consultant. We're working on a quantitative impact study as we speak. And my hope is that we'll use that to make decisions to the changes we need to AG 43 and C3 phase 2. And we want to do it by year end next year. So that's pretty heavy lift and pretty aggressive timeline. But I want to give a lot of credit to the members of the working group. They've put in a lot of effort. We've had some very productive phone calls, and just being a part of it's been interesting. But again, I just want to give that credit to the group and the NAIC staff, and we're really looking forward to hopefully getting something done by year end. And you won't be here to enjoy that, Joe, but I'm sure you'll still comment somehow. So.
Send me an email.
Yeah, you'll send me an email, right? Yeah, you'll text me.
I will be at the meetings and still attending the variable annuities issues working group meetings. Okay, thank you, Nick, for that update. I know it is a heavy lift, and we appreciate you taking on the challenge. And I know you'll make the end of 2016 deadline without any difficulty whatsoever. The next few questions are for all of the panelists. Hopefully, we'll probably break in about 5 minutes to take questions from the audience, so we'll get through at least the next question. But as all of you know, FSOC in its 2014 annual report suggested the use of captive reinsurance can add complexity and reduce transparency around the financial condition and potential resolvability of certain life insurance companies. So I guess I'll start off by saying, do you agree with that conclusion? And if you do or don't, why or why not? So Paul, if you want to start us off, that'd be great.
Sure. The use of captive reinsurance certainly can increase complexity and reduce transparency. That part, I think we've all agreed upon so far. But as far as, really impacting the potential resolvability of certain life insurance companies, I think that the fact that all the captive transactions are being approved by one, if not two, regulators, and that the regulators actually do have insight into the transactions. They've got tools, such as ORSA, supervisory colleges, and you know, simply communicating between themselves, that I don't think would ever really cause a problem with a resolvability issue, or quite frankly, you know, increase the risk of a company having financial difficulties in the first place. It really is, you know, the regulators doing their job, just like they're doing their job with the traditional life insurance companies.
Thank you, Paul. Nick or John want
to? I agree with some real limitations. I don't agree on the resolvability. I do have some agreement on the transparency. Again, in Iowa, we have been publishing these financials for many years, from day one to be precise, and it makes you a target at times, but we do put everything out there for investors, policyholders. They want to look at it. Anybody wants to look at it, for that matter. And so I do think that would be a good practice for everybody in these transactions, is to make that publicly available for everyone to see that. And again, what would a policyholder do with that information? I'm not sure, but I think that, you know, when you put light on things and you throw it out there, that's just a good practice, in my opinion. On the complexity, I think it does appear complex, but I think you could look at situations where some of these have aggregated different liabilities from a number of affiliated insurers and put it into one captive, and I would argue, as a regulator at least, it's probably less complex. And so, complexity from what perspective? You know, complexity from someone like, you know, my wife said the other night, what the heck are you talking about? Yeah, I'm sure she would think it's very complex, but from my team sitting in Des Moines that has that full view, as I described earlier, into the transaction, into the company, I think it actually probably lessens the complexity from our perspective. But on the resolvability, I agree totally with Paul. I don't think that's really an issue.
Well, having actually practiced in the area of insurance company insolvency, including life insurance company insolvency, and also serving on a crisis management group for a very large insurer that has life exposures, I can tell you that from my perspective, captive reinsurance agreements definitely could have a significant impact on the resolvability of an insurance company experiencing financial problems. And part of that is because of the nature of the U.S. system for resolving insurance companies. Unlike the banking system, we don't have what's called a single point of entry with respect to resolving insurance companies. Each of the insurance companies within a group, when it becomes insolvent, will be resolved under the laws of the state where it's domiciled. So if you have a situation where you have a captive insurer-owned captive domiciled in one state and the ceding insurer domiciled in another state, that resolving that group as a whole becomes much more complex. Basically, I think a lot of the rules that we're starting to implement make that less complex, because we have a little bit more, we have more transparency. We're going to have a better idea of what the actual assets are. But the question asks, do these transactions make resolution more complex or more difficult? And I'd have to say that, given the nature of these transactions and the fact that we do have multiple point of entry with respect to resolutions, that by their very nature, I think that it makes it more difficult to ultimately resolve an insurance company.
Thank you. Those are all very, very valid points. I guess we'll pause for a minute here. We have 15 minutes left, so I want to just pause before we get into the next or final three questions, I guess, but we'll give you time to ask questions if you'd like to do that, rather than take up the entire time with us speaking up here. So please feel free to ask questions if you will. You're not going to get out early if you don't ask the questions, so you might as well come up with some questions for our panelists. Yes, Commissioner.
Voice activate.
Oh, hello, Joe. In Delaware, well, we have 1,000 captives now. So when you saw the number 333, it was a little bit dated, but we just celebrated 1,000 last week.
I thought I saw an email to that effect. I was kind of confused when I saw that slide. I didn't realize.
Yeah, that's all right. I've been working in insolvencies for some 20-some years before I became commissioner. And when I came into the department in 2009, I was given documentation to put a company into liquidation, a life insurance company. And I asked, what does a liquidator ask? Well, how insolvent is it? Well, it actually can pay all of its claims, but it doesn't have its triple X reserves. I said, so it really isn't insolvent. So I had to sign a waiver, which we did. And then the company got out of supervision and we sold it. So we saved it from going into liquidation. And I really, it stuck in my craw, so to say. Am I allowed to say that? About this triple X reserve. So when we went to PBR, we really embraced it. We passed it in Delaware, and we do have it, so I do like it. Now, we have a lot of triple X and A triple X captives in Delaware, and I find it a very good vehicle to for companies to help give better pricing. I like Daniil Spector, what he said, that it's the seeding company. And I do feel that the issue lies with the seeding company because, as he did his report, we saw that, and which he said earlier, if you had a triple X or a triple X, that actually was redundant reserves, which we found when we decided to adopt PBR. So I don't think there's any secret there. And I find that I'm a little worried that we're working a little too fast or maybe not thinking out of the box. I actually have alien companies seeding alien business to Delaware, so I'm kind of not sure how accreditation works with, you know, France or Germany or Italy or whatever. But I also don't like the idea of maybe companies going offshore. And we do have companies now starting to say, well, I think we're going to go offshore now. I like having the company in the United States. Like Iowa, I do have some companies where the seeding company is a Delaware company and the captive is a Delaware company, but not in all cases. Some are foreign. But I like keeping them onshore. So I'm just a little bit worried about not thinking out of the box. And I, again, going back to the rector report, I'm repeating myself, I really think the issue lies with the seeding company. The seeding company has to be healthy. And I understand John's point about having a captive in another state with the seeding company being in California or some other state. But I think since it's in the reinsurance position, it's not as difficult in an insolvency, because I've had a number of them over 27 years or so that I've had to deal with insolvencies. So, just.
No, thank you for those comments, Commissioner. I think we agree that this, you know, we've approached this from the seeding company's perspective primarily. We do have some things going on with accreditation and captives and special purpose vehicles and so forth. But one of our intentions when doing the AG 48 framework, the primary framework, was to attack it from the seeding company perspective and not to drive these things offshore. It doesn't do us any good if we just try to restrict the way that captives are done onshore, and if we just ended up with companies going offshore to other jurisdictions where they were able to do it. So I don't think we're in disagreement there. As far as you know, insolvency, making a company insolvent based on triple X, excessive A triple X or triple X reserves, that doesn't serve anyone's purpose. If their reserves are overstated and the company is truly not insolvent, you know, hopefully any jurisdiction would recognize that and be able to save that company and resolve it in a way that works out for the policyholders and allows the company to continue to operate. But I'd be happy to take any comments from panel members also.
I agree with you, Joe. I don't think we want these to go offshore. And during some of this debate, we did hear quite a bit of that you're trying to add transparency, you're trying to do things that make some sense, and then you're going to push a lot of these offshore, and that is not the intent. And so I agree with that totally.
Thank you. Yes.
Alan Rothenstein from Milliman. Just wanted to comment on Deputy Commissioner Finston's remarks with regard to a workout situation. I've worked on lots of transactions over the last 10 years. In my experience is there are numerous lawyers involved. You've got internal counsel, both from the seeding company and the financing provider. Then you have external, typically New York or Chicago lawyers that, at their multiples of, not multiples, but higher billing rates than the consulting actuaries, and addressing these issues to try to make sure that if there ever is a workout situation, the transaction actually works. And in light of, and I can't remember which regulatory framework it is, I think the banks are being asked to provide a rehabilitation plan for what if they actually have to unwind. In many respects, if there's a problem elsewhere in the company, that I don't want to pick a line of business, but let's say there's a problem with a certain line of business, but it's not the XXX or AXXX business. This business being set up with a captive actually makes it isolated, and it makes it easy for the regulator to come in and say, you know what, let's say it's a regulatory action level event, and they're stepping in before insolvency, and they might say, you know what, let's sell off this block of business, and we've got the financing that'll go with it. Now, it needs to get negotiated with the financing providers, but it's the fact that it's been prepackaged, and all these lawyers have worked on the documents very carefully, my expectation is that it would actually work pretty well.
Thank you, and that's an interesting comment that lots of lawyers made things more simple. So
there were some serious, billable dollars in structuring it, but they make sure that it works for all the different parties.
Let's hope that we never have to test that. I hope you're right. Absolutely, hope you're right. Thank you, John. Go ahead.
I just like having been one of those lawyers in some of those transactions. I agree that we did a great job. But the question really went to, does it add complexity? I don't think it actually makes it simpler. I think it does add complexity. It's complexity hopefully you'll be able to work through. But the fact that you have multiples, you could under certain circumstances, unlike the situation that Commissioner Gerhardt was talking about where he tries to consolidate these transactions into a single state, I think that's a great solution. But in a lot of cases, they're not consolidated into a single state. So you have these frictions that arise, and it makes it more complex. It just does make it more complex to resolve that company. And we recently experienced that, for example, not so much on the life side, but on the resolution side with respect to the tower insurance group and, getting the states to basically coordinate and agree and work out a plan took longer because we had a lot of very complex issues to deal with. So that's really where my comments were going to. I think it makes it a more complex transaction with more issues you have to work through.
Thank you. I like the debate back and forth. That's great. I don't know who was up first, but do you guys know? Okay. Sure.
Yes, Dave Navy from Global Atlantic. My question is regarding the penalty for noncompliance with AG 48. I mean, AG 48 is the law, and you need to comply with it. To my knowledge, none of the other actuarial guidelines pick one. AG 43, AG 38, AG 33, AG 34, none of them have a prescribed penalty if you don't comply. So why does AG 48 have this sort of articulation of here's the penalty if you don't comply? Is there something unique about AG 48 that requires that?
So just to the scenarios that I was talking about really go to the regulation that we're working on and the alternatives that we're considering. So it's not really AG 48. I think AG 48 basically results in the enforcement mechanism of, if you want to call it that, in AG 48 is really the impact of having a qualified actuarial opinion. If you don't comply with the requirements of AG 48, then the actuary has to issue a qualified actuarial opinion. And there are ramifications in the law with respect to what happens if a qualified actuarial opinion is issued. And I think I've got that right, Paul. Yep.
And that's correct. And part of the problem, I mean, the question was when AG 48 was created, what's the hammer? What if companies decide, well, it's still worth my while to you know, not fund it with the, you know, the proper amount of primary security or the calculated amount under AG 48. So, you know, the thought process was, well, a company's not going to want a qualified actuarial opinion. There's a lot of controversy actually around that because the actuaries are looking at it and saying, well, what if this is a small piece of the business? I've got to give a qualified actuarial opinion when this may be an insignificant piece of the company's business, and they've got a point there, and they shouldn't be forced to issue a qualified actuarial opinion. And we're working on ways to I guess fix that problem through the RBC charge that a company will get if they don't comply with AG 48. And there is already an RBC charge contemplated that will really make the need for a qualified actuarial opinion go away. But it's still in AG 48. It hasn't come out of AG 48 at all. But there's still open discussion on that. I'm not exactly sure where that lies right now.
I think that's just going to sunset with AG 48 as it sunsets. And I guess I would suggest that actually all of those other actuarial guidelines do in fact have what I'll call remediation or penalties involved with not following them. And that is your regulator comes in and tells you you have to increase your reserves. You didn't follow it. So there's consequences to not following anything. When it comes to the law, it may not be explicit in the law.
Thank you. Brandon.
Hi, Brandon Bridgeland, Center for Insurance Research in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm one of the funded consumer representatives. I'm going to make two very quick comments and one question. The first is just very general. I wanted to thank all the commissioners who were involved in putting on this presentation, for both arranging this and for all the hard work you've done over the last several years and, you know, developing AG 48, working on a model, working on PBR, you know, all to help, you know, protect consumers going forward, and I appreciate that. Second thing is, one of the things I do here at the NAIC and one of the issues I always try to, you know, focus on is transparency and transparency to the public, unless there's a really compelling reason why, you know, some effect or facts should not be transparent. And it's troubling to me to hear, you know, a representative from AM Best, you know, on the panel say, oh, you know, we have access to, you know, all this information which, you know, we keep secret. They're not a regulator, you know, they're not, you know, conducting using a regulatory exam process. But, you know, nevertheless, you have, you know, some private parties receiving secret information while it's not available to the public, and I find that troubling. I'll laud, you know, Iowa for putting all of that, you know, on the website. And I would say my second comment is I would really encourage, you know, as the work continues here at the NAIC, is think about ways and mechanisms to encourage states to, you know, do the same as Iowa and make the information public, which leads to my question, which is really directed towards the representative from ACLI, is for a multi-state or, you know, a captive that has multi-state reach, and by which I mean not a self-insured nursing home or the like, what justification is there for, you know, keeping basic financial statements private or secret and not available to the public? As, you know, one of the consumer representatives, consumer groups, and I know some others, there aren't a lot of us, but some of them do go out and read annual statements, and we get requests from policyholders, you know, about what we think about X or Y or Z, and, you know, we come to a company, and unlike any others, well, you know, they have this transaction, but it's all secret, and, you know, we're not allowed to, you know what's going on, trust us. What justification is that for these, you know, for a captive with multi-state impact?
That's a great question, Brendan, and one of the things that ACLI did, you know, when the captives issue started cropping up was to say that we believe that the biggest problem with captive reinsurance is the lack of transparency and disclosure. And we have always been, you know, promoting the development of proper disclosure. And as Commissioner Gerhardt mentioned, they came to industry and said, you know, how should we be disclosing these types of products and captive arrangements? So we are very much for transparency. Having said that, one of the problems with transparency is you need sort of a set of rules that are being followed to disclose or disclose your results against. And as came up earlier today, a lot of the captive laws have they have rules that are not, you know, like a credit or our AP&P manual. So there's no prescribed accounting for it. So disclosure without understanding what it is that's being disclosed can be very misleading. So as we go through and figure out what's good for disclosure publicly, we always are trying to make sure that there's sort of a requirement that you can point to and say, you know, here's how it's being accounted for, and here's the number. So, and that's what's taken us a little bit longer than normal, I guess, you know, as opposed to just saying, hey, why don't you do a blue book for your captive?
And I know I'm the last comment standing between you and dinner or your bars or wherever you're going, so I'll keep this brief. But I agree with your comment, and you know, we through regulation made those public for folks. And again, it puts you in a spotlight because there is no frame for some people to understand some of the things we've put out there. But I think that I still would err on the side of doing that.
Thank you, Brandon. And just to, you know, to add, thank you for the kudos to us for working through these issues. But the credit goes to the insurance department staff, who's done all the work to make us look great. The NAIC staff, who have done a ton of work. Rector and Associates, who has done an incredible job with the AG 48, AG 38, and all the other issues that we've thrown at them. And Oliver Wyman now, who's helping us out with the variable annuities issues. So, you know, the credit should be spread around to everyone who's been involved. And the industry has done really, has been very, very helpful to us, cooperative with us, ACLI. I talk to Paul constantly, and I'm going to miss those conversations once I'm done. Maybe I'll just give you a call every once in a while to talk about AG 48. So. Thank you. I think we're out of time, and I'm going to ask Director Huff to come on up and end the session.